This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I am Samuel Mann, and I am joined again by the very fabulous Tim Lynch.
Oh, so these introductions just get better by the day.
How's the semester started for you?
With a bang, quite frantically, yep.
Is that a good thing?
It is a good thing. It is. I always underestimate, you know, the amount of energy that students bring back with them after they come back from a break. You kind of lull yourself along the breaks, and you hit a sort of tempo that you amble along there, and then the students come back and she's back into it again.
But that is not distracting you from studying Hope.
No, it's not. Hope this week is in Hope and changing models surrounding hospitality, tourism, things like that, and what that could possibly look like. And I think one of the better examples I could find of it in Dunedin was in a place called Taste Nature, which has been around for, I think, don't quote me on this, at least 30 years, I think. And my first interaction with Taste Nature came when they were a little outfit round on Moray Place. And a friend of mine worked for them. And when I say worked, he just volunteered there. And it was a community organisation, basically as an outlet for organic growers locally. And that was my first sort of interaction with it. And from there, they've grown into what is a pretty sophisticated, multi-dimensional business model. Very forward-thinking, very forward-looking, and really embedded in a lot of different community aspects. So I had the chance to sit down with Clinton Chambers, who is the head honcho CEO of Taste Nature.
So my name is Clinton Chambers, and I'm the owner, managing director of Taste Nature, Taste Nature Organic Supermarket, Cafe, Apothecary, Integrative Health Clinic, and Organic Gardens, and founder of the Taste Nature Social Enterprise here in Dunedin. How did I end up with Taste Nature? I've sort of been in the industry for such a long time. I've been in hospitality and tourism for 30 years, and I'd sort of felt I'd come to the end of my working for other people. A friend rang me up one day and said, you know, would you be interested in a business opportunity? And I'd always worked for other people, and my management style is kind of go in and fix things up, a fixer-upper, or whatever you want to call it, or change management, I think they call it. And I thought, oh, this could be interesting. And so we started the process of looking into buying this business. And by the time we went through all the due diligence and the finances and all the legal stuff, I kind of felt this is a really good opportunity for me to apply my skills and my talent for doing up businesses, but do it for myself rather than for someone else. And my background is I've always been an advocate for natural health. So there were elements of Taste Nature 70 years ago, it's been 7 years now since we took over, that aligned with my own values and view of, I guess, life and medicine. So it was an easy transition or easy business for me to step into because there are so many similarities that I'm quite passionate about. Currently, where we are in High Street, 131 High Street, I think it would be nearly 15 years at this site, and the previous owners, Mark and Raina, originally bought one section, and over the years they expanded, took over neighbouring sections of the building. And when we came on board, we just kept extending. So the shop has almost doubled in size. And then up here, the opportunity came to take over the office spaces up here. And I always wanted to have a clinic attached to the shop. So when this space came available, it was an opportunity that I couldn't walk away from it, but it was unexpected. Even though I'd planned to have a clinic, I didn't have any idea where that was going to be or how it was going to work. And this came up, and it was like, do it now or die sort of situation. So I had to take it on, take over the lease with no sort of business plan or structure in place. It was one of those moments, just do it.
How would you describe Toast Nature? How do you describe it to people?
Yeah, so essentially we've built on the ethos and the values of Taste Nature when it was started back in 1992. And I think the desire back then was to be able to provide organic food or chemical-free food to the public. That was the whole concept and having an outlet for that. So around, there's always been a market for organic food. And because it's a kind of a mindset or a way of thinking, if you grow organically and eat or have a diet predominantly organic food, you can't help but be part of an ethos anyway. So there's already an established community just around the idea of organics, no matter where you go. And so I guess the original owners really tapped into that and wanted to create something for Dunedin market. And then from that, it was sort of a community focused project, and from that, the community built from them establishing the Taste Nature store back in 1992, and it's just grown and grown since that time. And for me, coming in, it was taking it to the next level, making it more mainstream, because it's always been perceived as a little bit fringy and alternative.
In that case, is it more than a business?
Yeah. Organics by nature is more than economics. It's a way of living. It's a lifestyle and a level of self-awareness and, yeah, self-consciousness, because you're conscious about what you're consuming.
Is it, you know, conscious consumption is sort of one side of it, but it's almost like what you're alluding to is more this idea of a meaningful life?
Yeah, what you consume has meaning and purpose. Yeah, so organics is about preserving ecosystems and the environment and actually eating safe food. So it's going against the mainstream model of spray crops, you know, of agricultural model of monoculture production and using chemicals to grow food. So it's a massive diversion from all of that into let's work with nature. So it's about having a connection to where your food comes from.
So that symbiosis is within the community and the environment, and your business is in the centre of that?
Yes, for Dunedin, yeah. So all the main centres throughout New Zealand has something similar to Taste Nature, where there's an organic shop or a shop that has promotes organics. And there's always a little bit of a community connection around those stalls.
So it's obviously principles-driven and values-driven.
Absolutely.
Is there a tension between running a business and those values?
Depending on, I think, your demographic and where you're located. But we're fortunate in Dunedin that I think it's the right size, that there's probably not enough capacity to have multiple businesses with a similar product range. But for us, we can do it quite safely without having to make too many compromises and still be financially sustainable.
I'm just sort of wondering how you navigate that sense of purpose. Obviously it's with yourself, but how you navigate it with the staff and the people that work here as well. Is it something that percolates into the everyday operations of the business with your staff?
Yeah, I mean, I think all businesses, the culture and the ethos of the business is top down, so it comes from the top, those values and ethoses. So as I'm essentially, I'm the brand, I'm the business, and so my values and my perceptions and my outlook on life, I guess, are completely permeated through the business. So what I believe, then I create that the business has the same outlook and the same values. So they aren't separate for me. And because I'm putting my personality and my belief system into the business, that's what attracts, that creates the culture and attracts people to that culture. I mean, people love, especially in hospitality and retail, going into a restaurant or a retail outlet and talking to the owner, because it's a very personal touch to that level of service. And so that's why I'm always in the shop and make myself present and available, because customers like coming in and having a chat to the owner. I guess I've created the business model to suit my personality, so the jobs that I don't like doing, they're the ones that I delegate. But because it's important to me to give the business a personality, i.e. mine, yes, the systems and procedures, I guess, that I set up reflect that. But I think also more importantly, I extend the personality and the values of the business through the staff. So when I'm hiring, I'm obviously going to hire people that sort of aligned to what my values and visions are for the business. And there's a lot of people out there with similar values and visions. And so it's about bringing a creative team together to and not enforce, but just to create that atmosphere and that culture through all the multiple personalities, but all on the same ship.
It's interesting the way you describe that, in that you set the compass, but the team does the rowing.
Yes, that's how I see it. I'm at the back, sort of driving the ship, and all hands on deck, keeping it afloat.
Has that allowed you to make changes, respond?
Yes.
Be more agile than most other
Absolutely.
Businesses?
Absolutely. And it's an owner-operator business model as well. So only owner-operator businesses can be so agile and pivot so quickly. When you start introducing hierarchical structures, that's where it becomes more difficult. But, I mean, a good example of agile and pivoting is the lockdowns, COVID lockdowns. Like, within 24 hours, I turned the shop around from a store to a distribution centre. I could do that so very quickly, and the staff were able to adapt quickly. You know, having good systems in place certainly helps. But that's one of the benefits of being an owner-operator.
Let's be agile ourselves. Let's have a song.
Yeah, I know. Hey, if you've been watching the news, you'll find we're going to have a new medical school built. So
Whether we want one or not.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But I thought let's base all of our songs, give them a medical slant. So the first sort of medically based songs is by a band called Foles, and the song is called Inhaler.
Believe.
I mean, with that, you're obviously pretty conscientious about the environmental footprint of the business. Have you deliberately made changes to reduce that footprint?
Yeah, I'm very, very conscious of carbon footprints, definitely, and what we consume. I mean, if I'm promoting Taste Nature as a conscious consumer business, then I need to reflect those in how we run the business. So I have in our vision statement, you know, we have our values statement, and then we have our guiding principles. And within those, it's about waste management and having a minimal impact on the environment as much as possible. So I guess for running the business, there are things we just can't avoid, which is electricity and gas for the kitchens at the moment. Eventually we'll change over to electricity for that. Our biggest impact is where or how far the products that we sell travel, which is predominantly from all around the world. So as far as the business itself, there's certainly things that we can do to mitigate our carbon footprint, but I don't, the current model is about what you're consuming. I think there's a lack of recognition or acknowledgement on what you're doing to mitigate relative to the type of business that you have. So for retail or for hospitality, that, you know, the category that we come under, there is certainly innovative and efficient ways that we can do to reduce our wastage on the environment just by having internal systems and procedures in place.
So it sounds like you've had your carbon footprint measured for the business.
Yes,
so we have. Can you talk us through that, what that meant, how that looked like, what that involved?
Yeah, it was actually a pretty straightforward process, and I can't remember what our total output or what all those funny numbers were.
Well, and it's interesting to say that because, you know, one of the criticisms of getting your carbon footprint measured in the business is you just get this really abstracted number at the end of it.
Yeah.
what does this actually mean?
Yeah, you feel a little bit disconnected from it. And I think it does reflect the type of business as well, because if you're in manufacturing, then it's probably a bit more relevant. But because for us in retail, there wasn't a lot of measurables that we could control. You know, such as the usage of power and those sorts of things. So as far as reducing our footprint, there's not a lot we can do except maybe turn off the light switch more regularly. So I didn't feel that was impactful.
There must be things that you are doing within the business for mitigation, though.
Yes, and that's where our focus is. And that wasn't acknowledged in this model that's used to measure your carbon footprint, which is one of my arguments against the model. And I mean, I'm sure it's an effective model, but it almost needs to be a little bit more tailored to the type of business that it's measuring.
Do you think it's the type of business or the size of the business?
Could be both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we look at the big players.
Yes.
We look at the Fonterras of the world.
Yes.
They have dedicated departments. We're looking solely at these things.
Yes.
Whereas if, as you say, you're in retail, you're at the tail end of
tail
that.
End, yeah.
It's very hard to kind of work upstream, so to speak.
Yeah.
To have any kind of...
I think the scale has a lot to do with the effectiveness of that, those calculations. Yeah. So for me, it's like, well, let's... If anything, you know, for our business, it's not so much what we can say, but what we can say for the customer. So reducing packaging is something that we can do for the customer. So if people are looking into zero waste consumption, then we provide that environment where they can achieve those goals if they've set themselves those goals. So it's about helping the customer achieve their environmental or sustainability objectives.
And that would reflect in the way the business operates in general.
Yes.
So it's a customer-focused, community-focused organisation, and you're helping facilitate that on behalf of the customer.
Absolutely. It becomes our point of difference, even down to being a drop-off point for the recycling of the Tetra Paks or milk lids. That's where the community focus comes. We're enabling them to be able to recycle responsibly, and knowing that when the product does come into us, that it's actually going to where it is meant to be going, as opposed to some other recycling systems where they end up in landfill.
So it sounds like you've got, like, there's obviously quite large loops, product loops, that are happening.
Yeah.
You also have
circular economy loops. Yeah.
Yeah. So you also have a cafe. Do you incorporate that into the cafe as well?
Absolutely. So we have we collect all the food waste from the shop and the cafe, and this is, again, the business model reflects a model of sustainability, because we have the certified organic market gardens on our property in Waitati. So the food waste goes into a compost system, which creates the soil for our organic market gardens. So again, that's a closed loop for a food waste stream. And other efficiencies, you know, we sort all our rubbish, and we make sure we consciously, when we're packing food away in the kitchens at the end of the night, that they're put into containers. We don't like to wrap all our food in plastic in the chiller. So, you know, through all our systems, where we can make a difference, that's what we will do. And sometimes it can be not so economical, but we absorb that additional cost because we are conscious of the cost onto the environment if we don't.
Do you think, like, those mechanisms that you're putting in place, do you think they're scalable to go into other restaurants?
Absolutely. The staff have got to see the value in it, because it only works when staff are engaged in that greater, bigger picture for the environment. I mean, kitchens are the worst commercial kitchens are the worst for food waste, as we know. So it took months to train. When we introduced our food waste composting system, it took months to train the staff on how to sort the food waste, because there's just certain things that you can't have in your compost. And we also had a worm farm at the time, and it is an ingrained mindset. It's almost and deeply habitual, that it's constant reminding and discussions to get people out of a mindset into a new one. It wasn't even a habit, like, to get them to develop new habits. It was very challenging.
Got two quotes here. Through all of our systems, where we can make a difference, we do.
Yes.
That sounds like a message to write down.
It does, especially when you say it that way, yes.
But that only works when staff are fully engaged. And then he went on to talk about an ingrained mindset.
Yeah, totally. And I think, look, this is a double-edged sword, and Clinton acknowledged this. On one hand, he hires people which are very much aligned with his worldview, the way that he sees things. In the same way that when my friend worked for Taste Nature, he did it voluntarily because he believed in what the company business was trying to do. The flip side of that is, what does that look like in a scalability? Like, how does that look like expanding? Because if you're a larger company, you know, if you've got multiple outlets, it becomes progressively harder to hire based solely on those principles. And so it becomes more about the kind of embedding of those principles in a systemic way so that they are ingrained into the DNA of the business. And I think that's the process that Clinton's kind of going through at the moment, is trying to figure out what does this value set that I have look like when it's actually bolted on or embedded into the DNA of a business structure which is still financially viable.
Let's have a second of your songs.
Alrighty. Let's go for something a little bit mellow, but still on the theme of hospitals. Let's go for JJ Cale and Call the Doctor.
Somebody call for a doctor. I think I'm sick. Ain't had my medicine in over a week. My mind's fine, but my body feels weak. Call a doctor. I think I'm sick. Yeah.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm with Tim Lynch, who's been talking to Clinton Chambers of Taste Nature. Before the break, you were talking about the nature of business and the challenge of structuring a business that recognizes its values.
Yeah, and the tension between the two, because often in business, and I generalize, and these are really big broad brush strokes going on here, but when you have like purpose-built businesses or values-framed businesses, they tend to kind of sit on the left side of the political spectrum. And as such, they do tend to appeal to the kind of those that like to sit outside of structures or conventions. It's the marrying of those two concepts which becomes where the business becomes really interesting.
So you've got the for-profit component of the business, which obviously has to be there, but you also describe yourself as a social enterprise.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for you personally, the social enterprise part of it?
So I created the social enterprise because as much as I love organics and integrative health, the people that need it the most can't afford it. So I created the social enterprise to find ways and channels to make good food and good health more accessible to a wider demographic. And so through the social enterprise, we have what we call the Taste Nature Learning Community. So the idea of the social enterprise is to create change, consumer products and health and education. And we feel the best way to create change is through empowerment rather than constantly telling people how to change. We look at finding ways of how we can empower them through knowledge and information with the idea that they will take that on board and then make different choices. And as you said, it was just a simple thing as the lids, as you were saying before. It's sort of creating new mindsets around how we approach health and well-being. So that's the ethos of the social enterprise, is education.
So what does it look like in terms of I come to you and I say, look, Clinton, I'm having issues with what I'm eating, or some part of my diet is not working for me, and then you view me as a holistically as a human, and you go, well, okay, this is what we do, this is what I can provide to help you with that potentially.
Yes.
And it could be anything from massage, diet, well-being, mental health, all of those things.
Yeah.
And so it becomes the starting point of somebody's well-being journey.
So I kind of don't work on the individual level. I work on the group level. So our education programs are about educating groups of people. But for those situations, because I've got the structure, when people do come to us with these questions, we can then say, well, you can talk to this person over here, or you can talk to that person over there. That person can also then go, well, I can look after this component of your health, but you can talk to this other person because they'll look after that side of things. And underlying all of that, how about we look at your diet and what are you eating? And let's go downstairs into the supermarket and let's go through some food groups. So we're the only integrative health clinic in New Zealand where we have full vertical and horizontal integration. Horizontal integration where the practitioners refer to each other, the same client, and vertical integration where they take them downstairs and they can actually go through the food products and the natural health medicines with that client under one roof.
Because there's nothing new about the notion of food being medicine.
It's in
pretty much every culture other than ours.
The rise of highly processed refined foods have taken that away from us, from the Western diet.
Yeah, very much. And you know there are various, you know, a lot of reasons to do with that, you know, wars, etc. I'm just wondering, because there's a kind of criticism about healthy food, and it goes along the lines of all healthy food is expensive. How would you respond to somebody saying that?
In some aspects it's true, but again it comes back to value, like how much do you value your health? Now if you've got stage 3 cancer, you'd probably value it a lot more. So it does come down to the individual and how, like, health is an investment financially, energetically and physically. So you can't separate those three components out. You've got to work on all three of them at the same time. And so the expensive side, it can be expensive, but there, if you researched yourself, like, because again, the thing with holistic health is that everybody is unique, whereas a Western medical system treats everyone kind of the same. One pill fixes it all. So part of the journey to health and well-being is actually knowing how your body works, what it's adverse to, what it responds well to, what triggers it if you do a little bit of too much of this, what's your physical limitations. So that journey, you've really got to start working on how your body responds to the environment. That includes emotions and thoughts. So once you've sort of worked through that, you get an idea of what works and what doesn't work. But some of the things that will work don't have to be expensive. It could just be eating a few more greens. You know, so, but you've got to investigate that. Absolutely. I mean, wheat is a good example. The bread that you buy at supermarkets that is highly processed and refined is so stripped of nutrition that they have to add it back in. So wheat is naturally a nutritious, and especially sourdough, which is a fermented product, which is great for the gut biome. Those are the things you get from bread, that you should get from bread. So again, eating, like if you had a diet of high white processed bread, you're probably going to get quite sick after a year of putting that into your body. So again, the weigh up the cost. So yes, it was cheap bread, it's a cheap meal or cheap to fill up on, but for most people they probably end up in the public health system because it's going to cause complications.
Is there also an element of trust here, that you're trying to re-establish trust within these food systems for your customers?
Absolutely, and that our whole brand is dependent on that trust. So that's why it's important for me as a business owner to ensure every product that goes through this shop is, you know, aligned and ensures that we uphold those values of trust for our customers. I mean, we take a lot of the research out of customers looking for ethical or natural sustainable product. You know, I can go out and find those on their behalf, kind of like personal shopping.
There's a lot around sort of positive psychology in what you're talking within this, and how that sort of responds with people and how they think, view on an everyday basis. And within that, there's this idea of resilience. Now, you must personally have a lot of resilience to be in this job. We'll come back to that a little bit later on, but also the business must have a fair bit of resilience to be here. Have there been times that have really pushed that notion of resilience in the business?
Yeah, absolutely. Running a business of this size and with a multitude of projects that I keep putting on myself, and even the, you know, the economic environment in New Zealand, I don't think you wouldn't go into business if you think it's going to be a walk in the park. So resilience yes, is crucial, but we're talking emotional resilience, mental resilience, and physical resilience, and financial resilience. So all of those aspects, you've got to be constant. I personally have to keep constantly working on to ensure that I'm maintaining that level of resilience to keep the business going, because if I fall over, the business will suffer.
Yeah, I mean, I've had this conversation with a lot of business owners that run purpose-driven businesses, and they talk about this purpose fatigue.
Yeah.
How do you overcome purpose fatigue?
Probably sheer determination and energy. So I've been burnt out before. I know what it's like, and I also know what my limitations are. So I can work to a point and know that I'm going to be safe. And then if I feel that I'm starting to lose it, then I know how to manage myself to, you know, bring myself back to centre if I feel I'm coming unravelled. So I think personality types have a lot to do with that, and the level of commitment and vision, motivation. Like, if you've got a good vision and a sense of purpose, I think that helps get you through.
If you imagine taste nature as being like a third emotional space,
mm-hmm.
what are the emotions that you would want people to associate with taste nature when they've come in here, purchased something, and when they're leaving? What are those feelings that you'd like them to associate with?
I think a lot of the feedback we get from people who come into the store is a level of calmness, comforting, and warmth, which I really like, because those are the kind of emotions that responses that I aim to get from customers. And I think I'd add another one there, a level of safety, and they feel safe that there is integrity within the range of products that are available, and that they're not going to buy something that's going to be damaging to the environment or to their health.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I've always considered hospitality as similar to education in the respect that it's a liminal space. You come in one emotional state,
yeah.
And you leave in another.
Yes.
And it's that process of change that you, yes, go through there, which is requires a lot to be curated. When I sum it up like that, it sounds simple, but every day you put a lot of energy and effort into,
yes,
making sure that,
yes,
that occurs. What do you think hospitality in Dunedin or in New Zealand, what should we be hopeful for?
Does hospitality hope for? I think for me, it's what I hope for. What I hope for hospitality is exactly what you said. It's more about, they focus more on the social component, making the people feel good about themselves socially, because they're out and being social with friends and family. But nobody really focuses on getting the food right, getting the food make them feel good. Certainly with flavours, there's amazing cafes and restaurants out there that the flavours are amazing, but does that food also make them feel good, or does it just taste good? So I hope, my hope for hospitality is quality, a bit more quality in how the food's prepared and presented, and less reliant on processed flavoured foods. But then again, there's a lot of businesses out there struggling, and, you know, have to compromise on that to make ends meet. My sort of answer to helping hospitality businesses make a little bit of a shift around the food supply chain is, we're about to launch food provenance at Taste Nature Cafe. This is, again, in collaboration with the Taste Nature Social Enterprise, so both organisations work hand in hand. And so we're looking at funding 3 to 4 Dunedin urban market gardens. And we're going to, and it's a 1-year project, and we're going to fund getting them set up, not so much in building garden beds for them, but upskilling them. So the education component about comes in through the Taste Nature Social Enterprise to train them how to grow food in their backyard. So the idea is that we'll get them trained up, upskilled, and they'll grow food for the Taste Nature Cafe. So the Taste Nature Cafe menu has been changed or rebranded, which is soup, salads and smoothies, seasonal soup, salads and smoothies. So again, hospitality doesn't do a good job with working with the seasons when it comes to fresh produce ingredients, again, which doesn't help carbon miles, because food's been shipped all around the country or even internationally to supply a menu which has pretty much stayed static for however long. So we want to sort of turn that on its head and create a menu based on what's available. And as we all know, with weather events, major weather events around the world, our food supply chain's under threat. And the way that we want to mitigate that is to grow as much of our own food for our menu as possible, and also being low carbon mileage, so if it's in the neighbourhood, even better. And food, when it's prepped and prepared straight away, it's so vibrant. You know, it's full of flavour and nutrition, and that's how food should be eaten, not packed and like packed, chilled, transported. It's a terrible thing to do to food, but that's okay. That's how our system works. But we wanted to change it around and create a model where, in a hospitality commercial environment, we have direct access and almost control over what food we grow and what we supply ourselves with.
It's an interesting community-driven model, isn't it?
Yes.
You're in the facilitation of the middle of it, and it's cyclic in nature. It's really, I think I'll probably have to pop back and talk to you again in a year or so and see where it's gone on. Hey, finally, you've got a lot going on.
Yes.
Have you had to sort of change your definition of success?
Well, I think success is what you make of it, and yes, there's financial success. There's also the perception of what success is from outside. But for me, success at the end of the day is when I go home at night, am I happy? And yes, I'm happy. Not everything goes right. I'm not the richest man on the planet, but I've got a good life. And I see that as success.
Thank you, Clinton. I have lots of questions.
Go on, Tim. Yes, go.
Do we need to be teaching hospitality people positive psychology?
Positive psychology is, honestly, if you go back to when talking to Bryce the other week, he talked about positive psychology in farmers. Do we need to be teaching positive psychology at school? Probably. I think we probably do, actually. Yeah.
Which leads on to the idea of purpose fatigue.
Yeah, I mean, well, purpose fatigue, I think everyone can empathise with this notion of purpose fatigue, but I think particularly it is when you have a situation like, say, Taste Nature, where the business is so closely interlinked with the person that's running it, and it's so entwined with their personal value sets, whereas any sort of deviation in the trajectory of the business is going to be viewed personally, or is going to come across as being like a personal front of those personal values, rather than being, say, potentially viewed as an area for the business to be fixed. And I think it's the separation of those, of the values of the person in the business. When I was learning to be a chef, I was told that's what you do. You never put your name above the door because you can't sell the business. And you never have your own personal values entwined within the business. But that's what Clinton's doing. He's saying, no, actually, the business is about me. It's about what I believe. It's about who I am. And then we get this really interesting conversation, which comes from that. What does expansion look like? What does scalability look like? What does this business look like to grow and flourish and get better? And so these ideas of sort of potential growth or exponential growth in businesses are starting to really be questioned. And one of the things that's starting to come out at the moment in a lot of businesses is this notion of a business being just the right size. It's big enough. I have a friend who owns a bakery, and the bakery, for the amount of work that he puts into it, it's enough to pay for his mortgage and pay for his family, and that's enough. It doesn't need to be any more than that. Clinton kind of sits in the middle of these two things, where for Clinton, it seems like his notion of expansion is actually pushing into the services. And that's where we get this integration of like community services and things like that, which is stemming from his business.
You had a discussion about, is healthy food too expensive, which he deflected into a discussion about how much you value your health, and health as an investment and food as health. So why aren't you teaching in the health faculty? Why isn't food in health?
That's a superb question, Sam. And I would argue that it most certainly should be. It's food is not something which is discrete and separate to our well-being and health. It's integrated and entwined within it. I would also argue on that point that we don't actually have a cost of living crisis. We have a cost of nutrients crisis. I can go to the supermarket with $5 and I can buy myself 2 packets of chocolate biscuits. No problems at all. I can't buy a cauliflower. I can't buy fresh fruit, which is nourishing and will sustain me and my family. And this is where this disconnect is starting to occur societally. So if you're having to make way in life at the moment and things are tough, well, one of the few things that you have any kind of agency over is how much you choose to spend on food and how it is being spent. Now, I would also argue from that inevitably that cost gets picked up downstream in other areas of society.
You talked with Clinton about food being an emotional space, and they particularly design their environment to be calm, comforting, warm, and safe, which seems like a pretty good description of the things that food does. Is that what we're looking to do in your doctorate, is to scale those things?
In some way. And I think if you start thinking of like a third emotional spaces, that those areas which lie outside of work and home and where we interact with other people and often with strangers. And it's the navigation of those third spaces which is becoming more important, I think, within our societies. I think in other areas, I mean, the classic idea of a third sort of safe emotional space is the pub in the UK. You know, they've had that for a long way. And if you look at other societies, they have other areas for third emotional spaces. In New Zealand, we're only just starting to sort of see the importance of them and the role that they play. For me, it would be when I play ice hockey badly, but it's a third space that I go to and I meet a whole lot of strangers and we're there for a common thing. The importance that it plays on is massively important to me. At the moment, I'm going to the bloke's shed. They're doing some repair work for me. The major currency when you go down there is in conversation. That's the bit that's important, and it's creating a third space for men to be able to go to, talk, exchange, be friendly, free, and in an environment where they are safe emotionally and physically. The importance of that is massive. And once again, if we go back to that notion of positive psychology, all of these things are interconnected. So my role that I can play when I go down to the bike shed when they're repairing stuff for me is I take food down to them. That's what I can contribute. That's what I give forward. So is my doctorate looking more and more like a way to navigate these liminal spaces, which sort of also act as third spaces where there is confrontation? Absolutely. That is 100% where my doctorate is starting to go. And so this is where this framework of hope, of anger, hope and action comes from. Because if you think about hope, you know, hope is dangerous because you're risking disappointment. You know, you're confronting things you might not wish to be there. And so how do we navigate that?
And in terms of hope and hospitality, there was a bit near the end of your discussion with Clinton where one of you talked about, I think it was him, but you agreed, it's not just about making the food taste good, but the making the food feel good.
Mm. And that notion of, I mean, it seems really like a really simple, obvious thing to say, is that after you eat a plate of food, it should feel good. You should feel positive and you should feel uplifted. I mean, there are exceptions to that, and that's obviously when you're having, you know, poutine or some other sort of comfort food, which is massively full of carbs and fat, and at the time it's just wonderful. But as a general statement, you want your food to physiologically as well as psychologically be uplifting for you. To be something which is, you know, nourishing for your well-being and how you are physically feeling.
And as far as like teaching goes, that's a very difficult thing to teach students, is like, how do you create food which tastes positive as well as has a whole lot of other positive attributes to it?
Because that feel good includes knowing that it's come from a sensible place and sensible systems and those things.
Yeah, and that's...
Which
that's,
is a challenge if we haven't got those sensible systems.
100%. And also, you know, if you think about the current economic climate that we're in at the moment, we've got a lot of inflationary pressures, discretionary spend is down. You know, if your continual exposure to food is something which is heavy, fat-laden, and something which is, not positive, you will start to view it as being a positive thing. It's Maslowian.
So what's the takeaway for your thesis and for your teaching for this week?
The change is positive, change is possible, and that it is possible to start incorporating and integrating like societal and community facets into a business model which is still fiscally responsible. Because at the end of the day, it's still, you know, Taste Nature still has to pay the bills. They've got no way around it. But they're starting to bolt on all these other things surrounding supply chains, localized food resilience, the ability for, as he was talking at the end there, to be able to go out and start planting out vegetables in your back garden and take it down there and he will buy it off you. And we're starting to see those models being replicated more and more in Dunedin because we're the right size for it. It's an initiative the DCC are pushing at the moment. It's a bit early to talk too much about it, but it may be something we talk about later on, is how do we embed that notion of community and food and resilience in a way that is fiscally responsible and that is going to allow for hospitality businesses to be the best version of they can be. I mean, that's the thing that possibly could make, on a food way, Dunedin unique and different to every other city in New Zealand.
Thank you very much for joining me. What are we going out to? On medical theme, I'm going for the theme from MASH.
We're going to go for a band called The Editors with the best named song ever, which is Smokers Outside the Hospital Door.
As you can through this field of trees. Say goodbye.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, who are brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I've been joined today by Tim Lynch, who brought his conversation with Clinton Chambers from Taste Nature. I'm Samuel Mann, and that's Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Nga te wai.
Can we stop?
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.